In a few days' time, it'll be 75 years since that infamous day when the Japanese Air Force bombed Pearl Harbor. Hundreds of Americans were killed. Many more were horribly injured and operated on in ghastly circumstances. But how many died? Not because of the surgery, but because the anaesthetic or its delivery were inappropriate. Dr. John Crowhurst, who's a consultant anaesthesiologist attached to the Women and Children's Hospital in Adelaide, is convinced that Pearl Harbor changed the way drugs were used to knock out patients, and our confidence in the injections we now get stems from that terrible day.
Since the Japanese military attack on the US naval base at Pearl on the 7th of December 1941, most anaesthetists in the world have been taught that sodium thiopentone, or pentothal as it's commonly known, caused hundreds of perioperative deaths in the 1,178 casualties that resulted in the battle. Now, it's believed that about 1,000 of these required emergency surgery in the subsequent 24 to 48 hours. Now, when I was a medical student in 1971, my consultant said to me, "Son, if you go on to do anaesthesia, you must use this thiopentone with great care and diligence, because the Yanks killed more of their own at Pearl Harbor than did the Japanese in their attack in 1941. Well, I was quite amazed, and I asked him, how did he know that? And he said he was told that when he was a trainee in Belfast in 1949. Now, that has fascinated me ever since. That story has been told to thousands of anaesthetists and anaesthesia trainees all over the world, including the USA. In 1992, the year after the 50th anniversary of the attack, a good friend and colleague of mine, Frank Bennett, a consultant anaesthetist in Kent and an active member of the History of Anaesthesia Society, published in the US Anaesthesia Society newsletter a review of thiopentone anaesthesia since its introduction into specialist practice in 1934. And that was entitled Thiopentone, Chicago to Pearl Harbor, and included much detail about its use at Pearl. Now then, in 1995, after reviewing US military documents released under the US Freedom of Information Act, he published what has become the most definitive paper on the Pearl Harbor anaesthesia events. That was in the British Journal of Anaesthesia in 1995. The paper acknowledged that censorship by the US military of the extent of the thiopentone morbidity and mortality was possible, because no actual numbers of such complications have ever been revealed by the military authorities, notwithstanding that few detailed records of anaesthesia were kept. In addition to that, there was no actual classification of anaesthesia death as we have today. Many died during surgery, or they died from their wounds. Now, Frank Bennett's concluded that the rumoured death rate from this cause has been greatly exaggerated. I suspect that the death rate, which he was referring to, was the anecdotal one alluded to me in 1971, and which was also told to him, as he cited in his 1992 paper. I disagree with his conclusion that the rumoured death rate was greatly exaggerated, but accept the fact that the actual number of true anaesthetic deaths from pentothal will never be known, because few, if any, detailed records were kept. In 1941, the hazards of using thiopentone in severely shocked and traumatised patients were unknown to the military nurse anaesthetists and the other junior doctors and technicians who were responsible for administering anaesthesia at Pearl. Cardiovascular collapse and respiratory arrest, together with a shortage of oxygen supplies, lack of resuscitative skills and equipment, and knowledge of thiopentone's pharmacology and dosage, along with a dearth, possibly none, of trained, skilled physician anaesthetists, clearly resulted in many tragedies. But just exactly how many will never be known. Some spinal anaesthetics contributed to perioperative mortality as well, and the available local anaesthetics at the time were quickly restricted to infiltration, mainly in burns patients. Now, a year after Pearl Harbor, Admiral Gordon Taylor from the Royal Navy, who was at Pearl, said spinal anaesthesia is the ideal form of euthanasia in war surgery. And Dr. F.J. Halford, a senior surgeon at Pearl, he added that, and let it be said, that intravenous anaesthesia is also an ideal method of euthanasia. That paper prompted a four-page editorial entitled The Question of Intravenous Anaesthesia in War Surgery. The question discussed the overall safety of thiopentone and outlined in great detail the extreme dangers it heralded in shocked patients and under conditions of war. The warnings were based on partial reports of military experience and not on trial, both under laboratory and clinical conditions in civil circumstances, as we would trial a new drug today. And thiopentone was new then, introduced into practice in the late 1930s. Moreover, it is cited that the question required discussion and an answer because it had occupied the minds of physicians and surgeons since the attack on Pearl Harbor, and partly as a result of the happenings there. Other papers in that journal and in many other journals during the early 1940s carried similar messages, but nowhere are those happenings quantified. It's not surprising, therefore, that during and after that infamous day in 1941, the nurse anaesthetists, surgeons and others responsible for anaesthesia quickly reverted to using and requesting drip ether as the preferred anaesthetic technique. A review of endotracheal anaesthesia techniques in the US military in 1945 in Italy showed only 10% included thiopentone, whereas in Britain and Australia and elsewhere, thiopentone was being used much more extensively in place of ether. Indeed, even in 1950, in the Korean War, the US military nurse anaesthetist continued to use drip ether, as depicted in some 5 episodes of the TV series MASH. In that war too, US anaesthesia equipment was not standardised and could not be shared with the British and other Allied teams. That is not to say that thiopentone was not used in small intermittent doses, much more safely, but its use in full induction doses was unlikely because after Pearl, the hazards of its use in shock patients was quickly appreciated by physician anaesthetists. After Pearl Harbor, the Mayo Clinic's use of thiopentone declined markedly, and it was at the Mayo Clinic that pentothal was developed and researched in the mid-1930s. But its use declined there, whereas in hospitals throughout the UK and the rest of the British Empire and Europe, the use of thiopentone increased enormously, to the extent that by the end of 1951, it was being used worldwide in 76% of general anaesthetics. Whereas at the Mayo Clinic, the expert centre of thiopentone, it was being used in only 52% of general anaesthetics. This decline at the Mayo Clinic is very significant because in the early 1930s, the US anaesthesiologist Professor Ralph Waters in Madison, Wisconsin, and Dr. John Lundy at the Mayo Clinic, they initially researched thiopentone and introduced it in clinical practice, and they demonstrated clearly thiopentone's many advantages over ether and other injectable thiobarbiturates. Ralph Waters appealed to surgeons and to the medical profession generally that more doctors should become interested in anaesthesia because it was only nurses who were administering it throughout the US, and that if advances were to be made in surgery and in anaesthesiology, then more doctors had to become involved. Now, following Pearl Harbor, a committee was established by the United States Medical Research College, and that committee appealed to many doctors to come and train in anaesthesia, which they did throughout the war. After Pearl, many doctors trained in anaesthesiology and began to use thiopentone more widely. But even in the Pacific area of the war, drip ether was still being used, and then, as I said earlier, as well in the Korean War. Now, the World War II tragedies, especially those at Pearl Harbor, were a wake-up call for surgeons and the medical profession generally throughout the world to improve anaesthesia. And finally, in the US, it had become clear that no longer was it appropriate for any junior doctor, nurse or technician to administer sophisticated anaesthesia for many surgeries, and especially to critically ill patients. This had been known for many years in thoracic and neurosurgery at specialist clinics such as the Mayo and in many other countries. Nevertheless, today, some 17 nations have large contingents of nurse anaesthetists who in a few regions still practice independently, mainly for minor surgeries and more simple procedures, colonoscopies and sedation and those sorts of things. In the US today as well, some 65% of general anaesthetics are administered by nurse anaesthetists. but the vast majority of those work under the supervision of consultant anesthesiologists. And it's normal practice in the US today for one anesthesiologist to manage three or four operating rooms, whereas here in Australia and Britain, we have a one-to-one basis for all our operating rooms and patients. So throughout the 1940s and after World War II, it was quickly recognised that the profession required appropriately trained anaesthetists with the knowledge and skills to use such drugs as thiopentone and the sophisticated equipment developed in the 10 years following World War II, and the many drugs as well. The Royal College of Surgeons established faculties of anaesthetists, and universities in Australia soon introduced postgraduate medical diplomas in anaesthesia, following the example of the 1934 diploma in England. By the mid-1950s, once anaesthesia had been recognised as a specialty, education, research, development all progressed rapidly, and examinations for fellowship of the faculties of anaesthetists, not just membership or diplomas, began in 1953. Well, following the British model, university and teaching hospitals in Australia began to establish teaching departments of anaesthesia in the 1950s. Their roles included resuscitation and critical care, which soon became known as intensive care, which along with emergency and pain medicine subsequently became specialties in their own right. Having reviewed more than 100 publications by surgeons and others in the years following World War II, and visiting and corresponding with many colleagues and others in the US and in Hawaii, I'm convinced that the thiopentone mortality rate at Pearl Harbor on that infamous day was considerably higher than the official World War II rate of 1 in 450 anaesthetics cited in a review of casualties by Professor Beecher, published in 1955. That rate included similar anaesthetic mortalities from other theatres of the war, including Italy and North Africa, and arguably was one of the first attempts to accurately define and classify anaesthetic mortality. Now, during a visit to Pearl Harbor and the USS Arizona Memorial in November 2014, I met with two of the nine surviving US veterans, neither of whom could tell me anything about anaesthesia events, except that one of them, when I asked if he had had the ether when he had shrapnel removed from his head, he said, "No, I had an injection." And he pointed to his right cubital fossa, the area in front of the elbow. And he said, "All went well with the surgery, but the next day, my surgeon came and told me that I had died during the operation, but that they had resuscitated him." Thus, he had received an intravenous anaesthetic, almost certainly pentothal, but no other details were given to him. Well, in summary, my thesis really in researching this work is that the significance and legacy of the anaesthetic events at Pearl Harbor were that surgeons, the medical profession generally, and the health authorities recognised the need for appropriately trained and skilled specialist practitioners of anaesthesia. Today's modern specialty of anaesthesia, or anaesthesiology, as the Americans call it, was born soon after Pearl Harbor and World War II. And the ether century, which really began in 1846, began to expire. Although ether did continue to be used well into the 1970s for many simpler surgeries in less developed centres, principally by general practitioner anaesthetists.
Dr. John Crowhurst, who's published papers on the history of anaesthetics in leading journals. He's at the Women and Children's Hospital in Adelaide. Next week, Professor Saga, as he's known from QUT, talks about a revolution in the way we could grow food in places such as Queensland to offer three times the nutritional benefit. I'm Robin Williams.